Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Phil Hayes Show.
Welcome along to the show. The Phil Hayes Show brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. Dan here from The Square Ball along with Michael and Phil Hayes from The Athletic as well. We're twice weekly now, Mondays and Fridays loosely. We've kind of varied things up a little bit as we've had no football to talk about, Phil. But we are here ploughing on nonetheless.
Yes, I'll just drop this in and say I'm away next week, so we will be absent for the early part of the week, but we will be back for Marsh's pre-Villa press conference, which we all need to hear, really, don't we? Not to mention the game itself, which we all need to see.
Absolutely desperate for football now. Need some badly. If you want to read Phil's stuff in the meantime, on the website, theathletic.com/Leeds Pod, £1 a month for 6 months to read The Athletic, theathletic.com/Leeds Pod. Yeah, the show is twice a week. So Monday we react to the game and Friday we preview the game. We're nearly there. Let's have a little dabble in the waters of the update then of the stuff that's happened across the last few days. And we are in an international break now, even though it seemed to seamlessly flow from the lack of football before it.
It's like an international break all season long, or certainly in the first half of it. But we are getting there. Leeds are trying as best they can to tick over. I think they'll be pretty grateful that there are a fair few players away who will get games and will get some hard training sessions away with their countries. They have been playing sort of inter-squad games behind closed doors. They've got a friendly today, again behind closed doors, so no crowd there, but it's just a fitness exercise and match fitness exercise more than anything. I spoke to Joe Gilhart and Sam Greenwood yesterday as part of the launch of the latest Leeds, a documentary that's out, Academy Dreams, which is on Amazon at the moment. And Gilhart was talking about last season and the fact that the way it was set up and the way the nature of his involvement in other under-23s or 21s as it is now, they were getting kind of limited minutes with the 23s because they were involved with the first team squad, but they were getting very few minutes with the first team squad because they want your kind of leading players that Bielsa was using. And he said, you know, it does really affect your match sharpness, that, and it affects how good you are. And there's the scope to do loads of running at the training ground, loads of fitness work, this, that and the other, but it just isn't the same. And I think that's probably the little window that Leeds are in at the moment. Marsh, I would imagine, will be concerned about the idea of a month of downtime when they weren't expecting it and weren't planning for it. So yeah, little games here and there, we'll keep them going and hopefully keep them fresh. But it's going to be pretty intriguing to see what the performance is like against Villa, because we are talking basically the full stretch of 4 weeks away from the season.
It's a little bit like when you spend too much time on the sofa, isn't it? And then you try and get up after being prone for a long time and it all hurts and you can't do it properly. It takes you a while to walk to the kitchen to put the kettle on.
Yeah, I'd like to think they'd be a little bit fitter than that. It's a little bit like if you consider yourself to be a runner from time to time and you don't do it for 3 months and then you try to go out for a 5K run and you think, oh, this would be easy. And then after a kilometre, you're dying and your legs are giving up on you.
I thought you were going to say a 5 minute run then.
Well, that's what it turns into. I mean, these guys are somewhat more athletic than us three. So we'll be fine, basically.
Hey, listen, I walk 92 miles. Don't you cuss my athleticism?
You did, without complaining once.
No, enough about us anyway. On the internationals, we don't need to go through them all. I was just going to say, Melier, question marks over not making the full France squad at this stage? Because he's still in the 21s, isn't he?
It's been spoken about a lot, this, the idea of him being a future France number one, and Leeds certainly think he's got that potential. I've written a piece about this for next week, early next week. The kind of message that is always given to him, which is that you came to England as a French goalkeeper. In your time in England, in your time in the Premier League, you have the scope to become the French goalkeeper. And there's a certain dynamic with the France squad because they've got Hugo Lloris, who's been an international for them since 2008, the point at which Melier was all of 8 years old. He's well over 100 caps now. He's very close to becoming record appearance maker for France. He's catching up on Lilian Thuram and will go past him during the World Cup. But Lloris pulled out of the squad for the Nations League game games that France have because of a thigh strain, which kind of brought to mind the question of how longer term do France intend to replace him? Because that must be on the mind of Didier Deschamps, that Lloris can't go on forever. And you do wonder whether on the other side of the World Cup, Lloris might start to ask himself how much longer he wants to balance the sort of dual responsibility of international football and also club football at Tottenham, where he's still number one and has a contract until 2024. And when he goes, when he decides to quit international football, then there becomes the question of who steps in. So, France have more experienced goalkeepers than Melier. They have Magan at AC Milan. They also have Areola down at West Ham United. But the decision last week when Lloris pulled out was to pull in a keeper called Alban Lafont, who some people might know plays at Nantes. He's only 23, but actually extremely experienced and kind of on a similar path to Melier in that he went through a lot of the youth levels with France, was under-21s keeper for a long time, and it was him graduating from that and moving up that really opened the door for Melier to become regular for the under-21s, which he has been.
He kept Melier out of the 21s quite a lot, didn't he?
He did, and he's an extremely good keeper, and he's already got well over 200 league appearances in France, so it's not that he's in any way raw, but he's never been capped by France. So, this is potentially, if he was to play, this is a kind of first opportunity for him to dip his toe into full international football. From what I can gather, the feeling with the French coaching staff is that it is better for Melier to sit in the 21s and play at the moment, particularly because the European Under-21 Championship is coming up next summer in Romania and Georgia. France will, I think, have a decent chance at that. They qualified very easily, conceding very few goals in the 10 games that they played. They haven't won that since 1988, so they want to take a strong squad and they'll want to compete strongly, but that will be a last hurrah for Melier. He, I think, will be 23 at that point, and he qualifies on the basis that he was young enough to be eligible for under-21s football when the qualifying campaign started. But, he is kind of in the final throes of that. This will be his last season. And after that, I think you'll see him more seriously knocking on the door of a full France call-up. But it's quite interesting that of all the clubs that are looking closely at Melier, who I think is fair to say now has replaced Rafinha and Phillips as, probably the highest value asset in the squad at Leeds. I suspect if clubs were bidding for everybody in the squad at Elland Road, he would be the one who would command the highest fee. It's quite interesting that Spurs are one of the clubs who are looking at him because Lloris is, getting into his mid-30s now. He is out of contract in 2024, and you would assume that Tottenham would now be looking at a succession plan for him. So, yeah. All in all, pretty eventful time for Melier, who I think this season has looked better than he ever has. I think the basics have improved. I think all round he's looking extremely assured, looking like a top-class goalkeeper, which is why I kind of thought that when the opportunity did open up for him to go into the France squad, the coaching staff there might take it. But if you cast your eye over Lafont, he is a really, really good goalkeeper, so I do understand that decision.
It's funny, isn't it, how protective we get over our players when it comes to international football. And I go all the way back to like Tony DiRigo not playing at left back when Stuart Pearce was, the stalwart in there for years. David Batty playing for England as well. And more recently, like Calvin Phillips, when people were digging him out for not being good enough to play for England, and he ended up as England's player of the year. But now he's not with us anymore. I'm not so bothered.
And also, I think
that surprises me greatly.
Yeah. I mean, his place is far from guaranteed as well, I think, with Bellingham on the rise. But I always used to feel like that with Nigel Martin as well.
Yeah.
Particularly the late David Seaman years when he was not as good as he had been. I thought, just put Nigel in, for God's sake.
I was just going to mention Martin because I think that's probably, looking at Leeds history, might well be one of the players who you'd feel most aggrieved about. But if you were being totally objective about it, you would say that he had the misfortune of being a top level, top class keeper at the same time as David Seaman was exactly the same, and coach after coach seemed to lean towards Seaman rather than Martin. We always had this in Scotland.
That's because they are Leeds-hating bastards, Phil.
Is that what it is? Yeah, 100%. We used to have this in Scotland because obviously there is the idea up there that everything and anything is slanted in favour of the Old Firm. So you would look at your own players and think, countless players, Hearts players here who should be in the Scotland squad, very few of whom ever got called up. And if you go back, you know, over the years, considering that Hearts are arguably the third biggest club in Scotland, although, you know, you get some argument from Aberdeen and Hibs, ho-ho. But not that many Hearts players have been represented by Scotland comparatively, given that it is a small country with, you know, a kind of small selection of clubs in it. So, yeah, you do get precious about your own, absolutely. And it is, the inclination is to look at Melly and say, wait a minute, he's you know, he's young, he's first choice in the Premier League, he's looking better and better. Why isn't he in the squad? But then if you watch some of Lafont, I think Lafont is likely to end up at a much bigger club than Nantes at some stage in his career.
I go back to the noughties, actually, and my relationship with England of being quite disinterested because I didn't like most of the players, you know, who were playing for the national team, but you're kind of obliged to get behind them because, well, you know, if you're English, you're likely to support England.
Brave John Terry.
Do you think that's a generational thing, though? Because when I speak to people who are older than us, of which there are still some, they seem to give you the impression that going back to the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and everything else, there was nothing like the same sort of challenge. And I might be reading this completely wrong, but the same sort of challenge to feel engaged with the national team on the basis of who was in it. Whereas I feel like with our generation and the generation below, the individual names and faces who are in the average lineup or the average squad do kind of dictate how much you care and whether you're bothered and how motivated you are by the results. I mean, I've always been a club man over a country man, which might be something about being Scottish, really. But it's, I do sometimes feel like it's difficult, for example, I guess, to be a club like Leeds who don't like certain players over the Pennines and then to put that aside when it comes round to international football. Can be done.
I think as well, it's probably down to the rise of the internet and like football has morphed into almost a cult of personality. If you like, you see how people like Cristiano Ronaldo have been lionized, for example. Very much these individual players become individual stars. And I know, like I look at my son's generation and they are all caught up on individuals and they all know the stats for each of the individuals in FIFA and what they score out of 100 and all that sort of stuff. So I just think it's just changed around us during our lifetime.
There are definitely people who seem to support players rather than clubs, if that makes sense.
They're normally Twitter weirdos, though, aren't they, a lot of them?
Yes. Rory Smith in the New York Times once did a piece on Rangers and Celtic, which had this comical but actually very necessary disclaimer at the bottom, which said, there are some people out there who believe that Rangers no longer exist because they folded, you know, many years ago, they went into liquidation and therefore are a different club. There are equally other people who believe that it is the same club and that they still have 50-odd titles and everything else. And he was saying on Twitter that after a subsequent piece about Neymar and just the feedback from it, he said, he was saying in the top three of most volatile things to write about and actually things that I never ever want to write about again, Neymar, Rangers and Celtic, and anything to do with Israel and Palestine, like the fallout from it is just massive. And the last one, I think, to be fair, has such political connotations and nuances in it that that's a completely different thing altogether. But I think the Neymar one was the point he was making, that you know, there are people out there who love Neymar and love him to the point where it doesn't really matter who he's playing for or what he's doing or this, that and the other. They just will not hear a bad word said about him. They won't hear anything that's kind of touching on grey areas as opposed to being black and white of this guy is sensational. So you're absolutely right. But I also feel as if club football has just become more and more important as time has gone on. I think the Champions League has almost risen to the point where it seems to matter to people. And I think people within the game, actually, as much as things like the World Cup and the Euros, it's every bit as big or is seen as being every bit as prestigious, even though it quite clearly isn't. So international football, I think from time to time, struggles to retain the attention that it would like. I wonder if it's a slight problem as well, that there is just so much football at the moment, and sometimes it's difficult to know exactly how to spread your attention.
In terms of polarising opinions, none more so than Victor Orta and the work he's done at Leeds. Have you seen the Telegraph interview that he's done this week, talking about basically where Leeds are in the pecking order at the minute, and spoke about Bielsa and Marsh and other things? What did you make of that?
It was very similar to a lot of what was said by Radrizzani in the interview that he did with us, and also the interview you did with Angus Kinnear on the Square Ball podcast.
Are you suggesting they're coordinating their messaging here?
Well, you would like to think that within a certain boardroom they would all agree on things, you know. Otherwise, yes, it would be quite scattergun. Essentially saying he felt Bielsa had to go, although interestingly, didn't really get into any of the details of why, you know, didn't want to, I think, or didn't choose to dig into the exact reasons why they'd done it. I think Radrizzani went a little bit further with that, and certainly Kinnear did as well. The bit that jumped out to me more than anything was when he was asked about what Leeds' prospects are in this division. And he said, and I think he's absolutely right to say this, and I would agree, that breaking into the top six at the moment is nigh on impossible. You know, it is. It's not to say that it couldn't be done as a one-off, but to be a top six side, Leeds need an awful lot of things to change and an awful lot of things to happen. And it's a bit of a sad reflection on the Premier League. But in fairness, you could say a lot about the major leagues around Europe, you know, that would be very similar. Not so different in Spain, not so different in Italy, not so different in particularly in Germany, where Bayern Munich just seem like they're going to win the Bundesliga for forever now. And his ambition, you know, or what he thought was realistic, was that Leeds could be perennially top 10, which isn't much of a romantic pitch, but I think is as much as you can realistically offer at this stage. And it does kind of go back to what we've said quite a few times about promotion from the Championship, that it kind of realigns and changes the way you have to think about what can be achieved and what's realistic. I don't think it's unrealistic at all that Leeds, as time goes on, could be a club who could win the FA Cup or the League Cup. But in terms of gatecrash and what's going on at the top of the division, it's absolutely miles off.
We should have kicked him out when we had the chance.
Yes.
I would have cut them all adrift and said, go in your Super League, go and enjoy it.
But that was part of the...
filthy money.
That was part of the debate, though, wasn't it? That on the one hand, you felt incensed about the arrogance of clubs saying, we're going to dictate what happens here and we're going to structure everything to suit our financial ends and our wishes longer term. But then on the other hand, you had people saying, well, perhaps in the grand scheme, it might create a better domestic competition, a more level domestic competition. I mean, this debate goes on in Scotland constantly, that if you rid the SPL of Rangers and Celtic, you suddenly create a really wide open field in which a lot of clubs could win the title. But then you lose your two biggest clubs and you lose, I guess, part of the attraction, such as it is, of broadcasters and other people looking in. You know, they go and it does diminish the profile that the SPL has.
It's about dreams though, isn't it, Phil? It all goes back basically to the dreams of fans, where you want to think you've got a shot at things, and the longer the Premier League goes on and the longer the Premier League model succeeds in its current form, the harder it's going to be, isn't it? Because it reinforces the people at the top, as we're going to get into with the finances actually in a minute or two. It kind of just, it cements the current order, and that's no fun as a fan, is it?
Well, look, I'm boring people to death about Hearts here, but there is a bit of a debate up north about the manager there, Robbie Nielsen, whether he's good enough despite his record, which is really strong, generally really strong over time. And I see people say, in order to get to the next level, we need somebody better, we need somebody else. And I know this sounds really defeatist, but I always think there is no next level. You know, this is it. This is as far as you're going to get, because...
This is turning into like a scene from Trainspotting, isn't it?
Look at the gap. This is where he's sat on the bench with his bottle of vodka.
We're Scottish, it's shite.
As Tommy saying to him, let's climb that hill. He's like, we're not going to make it to the top. What are you on about? Let's just go home. So, yeah, dreaming's really difficult in the Premier League if you don't have the money and the structure that your teams at the very top do. And it feels like it's getting wider than ever.
I think the change from the 90s as well, when... obviously we were all kind of growing up, is that Man United used to be dominant and were financially the powerhouse in it. But there was normally a couple of teams challenging underneath them. But if Man United had a bad year, someone else could win it. Whereas now you need probably six teams to have a bad year to give you any chance of winning it, because they all have so much financial muscle that they will probably get a lot more points than everyone else.
On top of that as well, the way clubs recruit now is totally different to the 90s. So whereas your squads, and it did change quite quickly, but your squads back then were made up predominantly of British players, and that's where you recruited from. If you were looking to take the best British players, the pool was smaller because you were talking about one country. Whereas now, because clubs recruit in South America very heavily and all across Europe and other parts of the world, the best players who are out there can come from anywhere. And if you have the money, you get more of them. And you can stockpile in the way that, you know, Manchester City do. They've got a lot of depth. They're not endless amounts of depth. This injury to Calvin Phillips means that they've got an issue in the centre of midfield. But you know, your reach goes much further. You now have networks of clubs, which means that you can kind of do inter-club transfers and everything else. I don't know if you've seen any of what's gone on between Watford and Udinese over the summer. But I mean, some of that, you sit back and think, well, you know, that seems somewhat questionable to me. So it is totally different. And I think whereas back in, I still think of the 90s, and Leeds in 1992 are probably the best example of this. In the 90s, it still felt like kind of anything was possible, depending on how the cards fell, whereas these days, not so much.
Leeds were actually probably the last example of that, because the thing that came after Man United was Blackburn, and that came from new money, didn't it?
Yeah, Leicester, I think, probably jump out as the equivalent because of how long odds they were, and because you just never expected at the start of that season that the squad would go anywhere close. But as everybody says, there was a reason why they were 5,000-1, and that is probably because if we all lived for another 5,000 years, it would still be the title being traded around your richest clubs, as is the point at the moment.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
And with that, we segue perfectly and neatly into chatting about the finances. And we're mentioning this because the Premier League distributions for money were revealed this week for last season. So we thought it might be nice just to do a little very brief explainer. We won't get too heavy on numbers because you can kind of start zoning out when you get too many thrown at you. Because I want to frame it around a question of, where's all the money gone? It's one of those questions you see come up on socials quite a lot, Phil. So should we attempt to...
Like her house.
Yeah. Should we attempt to answer that in a way that's hopefully digestible for people? And you may choose to agree. You may choose not to agree with what we analyse here. But here we go. Right. So it was Swiss Ramble who broke this down. So credit to Swiss Ramble on Twitter for the spreadsheet.
Follow them, by the way. They are very good.
Excellent.
Very
good. When it comes to football finance. So the long and short of it is the Premier League money is divided equally, part of it anyway, including some of the TV money for UK and abroad, and all the commercial money that the Premier League earns from, you know, rights deals and so on and so forth. Everybody gets 87.5 million quid. Yeah. And then there's another proportion of the money is awarded on a merit basis. So the higher you finish up the table, the more you get. It's 2.1 million per league position for last season. And then you get an extra 0.9 million per TV appearance in the UK only. So we got the 87.5 that everybody got. There's also the TV appearances gave us another 19.5 million quid. We were on TV 22 times, which is pretty high, actually, versus where we finished in the league. It's sort of comparable with clubs that are pushing for Europe. Then there's an additional 8.3 million for finishing 17th. Overall, 115.1 million. And we got the 16th highest amount in the division. We got slightly more than Southampton, who actually finished above us in the league because we were on TV a few times more. Framing it around the division, Man City got 153 million. Norwich got 100 million at the bottom. So we are sort of in the bottom third, if you like, which makes sense given the league position. And that's a drop down from the, was it 132 million we got from the season before? So the drop is obviously based around the lower league finish, essentially, and slightly fewer TV appearances. So 115.1 million for being in the Premier League. And that's before you get into, you know, revenue from catering, ticket, shirts, all that sort of stuff.
So yeah, this is a drop of about 70 million from last season. And if you break it down, it's 100, according to the accounts from the 2020-21 season, which are the most recent accounts we have, it's £110 million in central distributions, which come from the Premier League, and then an extra £22 million on top of that from TV and broadcasting income. The best way to look at this is to analyse what goes out as well as what comes in, because clubs do earn a huge amount of cash, and Leeds' total turnover in the 2020-21 season was 171 million. And when you consider that in the Championship, one of the goals of the board was to pass the £50 million mark for revenue, you understand straight away that being promoted is the click of a fingers when it comes to having more cash to play with. The central distributions of £110 million, that was only £2 million more than the wage bill, which was £108 million. So £108 million equates to 63% of the total turnover, and clubs do like to operate around about a level of kind of 70% wages to turnover
on that
ratio.
They're actually talking about bringing that in as a rule, aren't they? Like, is it UEFA level? Now they're going to say, so 70% of what you earn can go out on your wages and it's capped at that.
Which, to my mind, would be a really good idea. And I think that would
be... That's wages to turnover ratio.
It would be a good idea when you're talking about sensible financial management. The argument, I think, that will come in and always does come in is that if you are a club who earn vastly more than other clubs, when this rule drops or a rule like that is imposed, then you're automatically at an advantage because you are able to spend more on wages than other clubs. And because clubs who have a certain amount of income can't then just plough in loads of shareholder cash. And there are limits on shareholder investment amounts anyway at the moment. It's not as if you're just free to spend whatever. But it would...
Which is what Newcastle are finding.
Absolutely. The P&S rules, which is profit and sustainability, basically prevent clubs from just losing whatever they want to lose and spending however much they want to spend. So again, to fall back on Swiss Ramble, who detail this stuff really well, you're allowed a £5 million loss a year, but you're allowed to supplement that with £30 million of equity injection, which is essentially your shareholders putting money into the club. So in any given season, you're allowed to lose a total of £35 million a year. And over a 3-year monitoring period, that's a total of £105 million. So you do have scope.
It can vary, can't it? Yeah.
It can, but you do have scope to lose money, and you do have scope to build up debt and to use that in order to strengthen your squad. But it means that you can't, without breaching the rules, be a very wealthy Saudi Arabian buyer who takes over Newcastle and then pays £200 million to sign Mbappe. You know, you do have limits, and that was always the thing at Newcastle. It wasn't going to be the case that they were able to just walk in and start spending whatever they liked, because there are rules on this. People will argue over whether these rules are ever properly applied, and there do seem to be loopholes all over the place when it comes to bypassing them or getting out of them or avoiding really serious punishment if you breach them. But it does give shareholders and board members within a club the ability to finance transfer dealings in that way. I think the most notable thing from the last accounts, and the reason we're going off those ones rather than last season's, is that the 2021-22 accounts haven't been published yet and won't be released until March, April time next year, at which point we'll get a picture of them. But against the total turnover of 171 million, you had total admin expenses of 151 million. And if you take away the waived shareholder loans from the last accounts, which were used to improve the balance sheet, they were around about £21 million.
So that's the owners, whether it was Radrizzani or the 49ers, writing off debts,
yes,
essentially to them.
We suspect Radrizzani. I think most likely loans that he's put into the club. And you'll remember that in the Championship, he had to put up something like £1 to £1.5 million a month to pay the wage bill. Waiving those loans, you can add them to the balance sheet to make it look as if you've got an extra £20 million in the account. The money isn't technically there, but it's removing a liability that you would otherwise have to pay back. So the account's improved by £20 million. But if you disregard them, the overall profit in that season, 2020-21, was £4.6 million, which barely buys you Wilfred Nonto, and in the grand scheme of transfers, buys you next to nothing. You know, that is not going to fund your transfer business through the summer. So therefore, what you need in order to make signings, especially once you're into the Premier League and you're not getting hit with this sudden new influx of cash. You know, as time goes on and you stay in the Premier League, your wage bill rises, your expenses rise, you know, everything starts to meet together because, let's be honest, clubs don't tend to bank a lot of this money, do they? Clubs tend to spend everything that they get. And you'll notice at the moment there's a discussion going on about how more can be filtered down into the EFL. So there's been talk of getting rid of FA Cup replays, of certain clubs who are in Europe not having to feature in the League Cup. This is a bit of a make weight for the Premier League throwing more cash to the EFL. There are loads of clubs in the EFL who are a financial mess anyway, and it seems to me that while grassroots and the lower levels could definitely do with much more investment and should be getting it, the more money you give to Championship clubs, the more they're just going to spend, I think. And someone was telling me last week about a particular player in the Championship, not of any great note, who's earning £37,000 a week. And it's not difficult to see the problem there. and to realise that that isn't particularly bright and it isn't sustainable. But the issue you have is that in the Premier League, the wages are going up and up and up. So when players are no longer kind of Premier League standard and are looking to find clubs elsewhere and Championship clubs want to sign them, they have to stretch themselves and push the boat out in order to afford them. But if you are making a overall profit of £4.6 million, in order to buy players, you either sell some of your own players or you get your shareholders to put cash in themselves and to do it. There are other means, of course. If you can find somebody who will pay a load of cash to sponsor your stadium, or if you can significantly hike up your sponsorship deals for shirt, the front of your shirt and other areas of the club, then yes, cash can come in that way. But
that's a virtuous circle, though, isn't it? In that you need to start progressing up the league to increase the value of your sponsorships, and therefore, you know,
unless you happen to have some friendly sponsors,
of course, yes,
who may be from the same country as your club ownership, who may choose to make a sound financial commercial investment
and have met previously on several occasions
at the very top of the market as well.
Yes,
yeah, yeah.
But Leeds actually did really well with the value of the SBO Top deal, and then acquiring Adidas's kit sponsors. They haven't, I don't think, undersold any of the commercial opportunities. But they won't have, and part of the reason for that goes back to you saying at the start, they were on TV a lot despite the fact that they were down at the bottom of the Premier League. They have wide appeal to Leeds, broad appeal, and they draw in big TV audiences. They did in the Championship.
The example there is that Chelsea, who finished third in the league, were on TV 24 times last season. We were on 22.
It's appealing, yeah. No, yeah. Broadcasters do gravitate towards Leeds for that reason. They get big TV audiences, so that explains why. But I don't think there's much room for Leeds to substantially push the commercial income. I think they're doing as well as they can on that front. And without, you know, getting dragged back into the discussion about the stadium, there's nowhere to go with that until it's bigger. You know, until it's the size of it's increased and it's redeveloped, there isn't much they can change with corporate facilities or corporate opportunities. To coin that old Brian McDermott phrase, it is what it is until it is no longer that. So it's difficult. So I understand why people look at the club and think, you have a huge amount of money coming in. Why aren't you doing more in the transfer market? Why aren't you doing this or that? What I don't think is particularly relevant is applying the accounts themselves to that debate, because actually, to go by the most recent accounts, there wasn't a lot of cash left over when the season was done. But as people will argue from time to time, you can look to your shareholders to put in more.
Am I right in saying as well that certain infrastructure projects, which could include things like stadium and academy investment, don't necessarily fall within the scope of financial fair play as well? There are certain things you're allowed to do outside of it.
That was the same in the Championship as well. So not the entirety of your expenditure fell in, because again, with FFP down in the EFL and in the Championship specifically, you had limits to your losses that were allowed every year, somewhere up to around about £40 million. But that didn't include certain things, like you say, certain academy costs, infrastructure costs, because they don't actually want to hinder or prohibit clubs from developing stadiums, from developing training grounds, things that are going to put them in a stronger position longer term. That's not the idea of it. The basic idea of it is to stop clubs spending ridiculous amounts or excessive amounts on players and wages. You couldn't say it works, but that is the theory of it.
Well, I've broken this down into a fairly simple sum to see if this does go some way for you to be able to answer where has the money gone. So if Leeds were at 170 million before, let's round it up to 200 million for this season. Then with increased attendances, let's hopefully, you know, there's more money being spent in the stadium, on merchandise, so on and so forth.
Yeah, because just to add to that, COVID was obviously there for the 2021 season and therefore no crowds with the exception of West Brom on the last day. So
you know, 12 million quid down there, aren't you?
Yeah, and Leeds did say that the total cost of COVID to them from match days was in excess of 20 million quid. So absolutely, let's say 200 million.
So right, so 200 million is your headline figure. If you then go for wages to turnover of 70%, as seems to be the target, that would be a wage bill of 140 million, which I don't think is unrealistic for a Premier League club, given that we were at 108 million anyway. Let's assume it's gone up. So that leaves you basically 60 million quid to do everything in a year. So we're talking about cost of sales, which includes buying in your food for you to be able to sell it. And then you've got infrastructure updates as well. So if you do 5 million on the ground or 5 million on Thorpe Arch or whatever, plus then pay transfer fees as well for players that you've already bought. And we know that when Leeds came up, as Angus Kinnear told us when we spoke to him, a lot of the deals that they did then when they came up were back weighted. They didn't pay huge fees up front. It was nothing more than about $3 million at a time.
No, they never pay up front. And in fact, a lot of clubs don't ever pay up front for a player. Yeah. They pay an initial fee, but unlike City with Phillips and Barcelona with Rafinha, that's very rare.
So if you're looking at the players that we have signed and the amount of money that we've spent, a lot of that seems to have become due in the last couple of seasons. So even if it's 10 million quid for Rodrigo this summer, it's 10 million quid out of that 60, isn't it? So that's, you can see where it soon starts to disappear to. So where has the money gone? Is that a fair way to look at it?
Well, if we say that the turnover is at £200 million and you're saying, you know, working out the ratio of wages to turnover leaves 60 million, did you say? To look at the last accounts that we've got, the difference between the wage bill alone and the total admin expenses was £40 million. The admin expenses were £151 million. The wages were £108 million. So if it's similar and the same thing, you can cut £40 million off that £60 million total that you've got there, which leaves you with £20 million, which, again, is not a huge amount. And if you do have other costs on top of that, if you do have other things that drain that slightly, then it starts to dwindle down towards, as I was saying, the point where your profit is kind of round about, you know, in single million pound figures, 4.6 as it was, and doesn't leave you a huge amount to do. I think, unfortunately, whereas it would be great to think that there was £60 million left over every year to spend, there just isn't.
It's an expensive business, isn't it, running a football club?
They're not a cash-rich club, Leeds, and nor are many clubs in the Premier League. There are ways of getting money, but I think you're starting to see at Leicester now that even when money is getting piled in, sometimes it hits a limit, you know, and you have ownership groups or whoever else who can only go so far with it and can't do it forever. It's different if you're Abu Dhabi, because there just seems to be no end of money there. And also with somebody like Abramovich, who's clearly gone from Chelsea but was there for so long, he seemed to have kind of limitless independent wealth.
Yeah, and these clubs, the ones you identified, like you look at, you know, Man City and Chelsea, they've had a 10-year or a 15-year head start in some cases. Maybe it's like 20 years. Abramovich came in nearly 20 years ago when the rules weren't as tight on investment. So they just piled in billions of debt. And so they've got such a head start on the rest of us.
And now at every opportunity, try and pull up the drawbridge as well. They're like, well, I think actually that's enough of that.
Yeah, which is exactly what they did on Newcastle.
And that is why you have to fight it, because otherwise it does just become a monopoly and it becomes a little cartel which you can't break into. One of the most damaging things to Leeds was that the period when they were in the EFL was so long. It's so long. And it was so long at a time when TV revenue in the Premier League was rising dramatically, but wasn't in the EFL. Don't get me wrong, the TV deal in the EFL was changing from time to time and it did increase. But it didn't increase in the massive way that the Premier League rights distribution did. You know, that you were talking huge figures, which changed the potential of clubs and changed the ability of clubs to spend. And through that long stretch, Leeds did next to nothing to the stadium. They did very little to the training ground. There have been quite substantial changes to the training ground in Radrazzani's time as owner. And I do think that's to the club's credit, because it needed to be done. But it means that you get promoted with a legacy of things that need to be sorted. Basic things like media facilities. They're about to open at Thorpe Arch a new media room up there, which they've never had. You know, they have places that the media use for press conferences, but they're not designated press conference rooms at all. This will be a specific one. And stuff like that doesn't cost a huge amount of money, but you can find that when clubs get promoted that haven't been in the Premier League before or haven't been for a long time, there's a bill of about 5 million quid in order to get everything sorted. Things like satisfactory press facilities, so a good press conference room for post-match, televisions in the press box so that you can see replays and everything else. It costs money to install, and those are the bills that you get hit with. So whereas, you know, as you say, a lot of clubs have had this head start and have done, you know, like City, for example, the development at Eastlands has been vast and has made them a kind of world leader in the game for the facilities they have. Leeds haven't been able to do any of that. And there was a long stretch where even the one that always jumps to mind is that, you know, that summer where the talk was, if Fabian Delph is sold, as he was to Aston Villa, it will give Leeds money to buy back the training ground, to buy back Thorpe Arch and to activate the buyback clause, which was about to expire that year. It didn't happen. So it's not their property. And as far as I can tell, it's never going to be their property unless some negotiation comes further down the line. And yes, they do want to move to the city centre, and there's been talk of a new training ground in the city centre to make it more accessible. But the fact is, they've been paying huge amounts of rent on Thorpe Arch, as they were for a long time on Elland Road as well. And that handicaps you. It does. So whereas other clubs have all this stuff in place and avoided those sort of same liabilities, Leeds are still dealing with quite a bit of it.
Critics are going to hear this, though, and say, you're just defending the ownership for not putting money in. And
I think
what we're trying to do is just explain the situation as we understand it. But is there a fair criticism of the ownership and the two owners that we've got that are sort of hovering around this 50-50 split? It's 56 Radrazzani's Group Acer and then 44 for the 49ers.
The ownership could put in more money, but I think that's a different discussion to where's the money gone from the accounts, if you know what I mean. That's what I'm saying. The accounts kind of make the point that in order to sign players, you either sell some of your own, i.e. Phillips and Rafinha, or you look to the boardroom for equity that lets you do deals. I think if you're being fair, you would have to say that in the first two summers in the Premier League, nobody was sold. You know, it was an outlay of, in terms of total value of the players that they were signing, it was an outlay of around about £150 million in return for nothing in. This summer gone has been completely different in that the transfer business has been give or take, and they've probably spent slightly more than they've earned from those two sales. But there's very little in it. You know, Phillips and Rafinha, in the end, were worth about £90 million, a little bit more combined. And I think the answer to whether they should or could be doing more depends entirely on how your season goes, depends entirely on how you perform as a team. If the signings turn out to be good and the team falls into line and does well, then you would say that the recruitment has been sensible. If they don't, and part of the reason for that seems to be because the squad isn't strong enough or the strongest starting lineup isn't good enough, then yeah, that's where the fingers will be pointed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
One of the areas of great investment at Elland Road is the academy. Undoubtedly, they've put resources into developing the facilities at Thorpe Arch, separating them out. Investment in players, obviously, we've seen a lot of that as they try to increase the quality of the 23s and now the 21 squad as it is. And all this nicely dovetails in with the release of Academy Dreams, which is the docu-series on Amazon again, streaming from, it's today, Friday the 23rd of September. I watched the first episode this morning. You've seen a couple, Phil?
The academy has never been in better shape, I don't think, or not in the time that I've written about the club. And again, that is helped by being in a division where it is easier to invest. But it has, I think, been a priority of this ownership group to put money or throw money in that direction. And the one thing that jumps out to me is that whereas you can't pretend that Leeds haven't produced high-quality players over the years, and one of the people who appears in the earliest scenes of this documentary is James Milner talking about how important the academy was for him, I think what you see now is across, say, for example, the under 21 squad, a higher caliber of player generally in every position. It's not to say that there's a Milner in there. It's not to say that there's anybody as good as Delph, for example. Although I think there are some massively talented footballers in this group. But what they've managed to do is to create a squad and create a group where you do actually think that an awful lot of these players, if they don't go on to be Premier League regulars, will be Championship regulars, for example, or will have very, very good careers. When I was down at Millwall watching Charlie Creswell last weekend, I was in two minds looking at him thinking, part of me can definitely see how he becomes a first choice centre-back at Leeds and, you know, plays for years and years in the top division. There's also the chance with him that he doesn't quite reach that level. But if he doesn't, I think he's guaranteed to have an extremely strong career in a division like the Championship. I think one way or the other, he is going to be a really good footballer who is going to make a good amount of money out of this and is going to make himself a really good reputation. And I think everything will just depend on, you know, the scale of his development, probably over the next 12 months to 2 years. But there is the potential there for him to be a Premier League footballer, without any doubt. And it is thriving. I mean, it's been pushed up to Category 1 level, obviously, which was important. I know they were relegated last season, but I don't think you can point the finger of that at the academy or the squad.
Spoiler alert, Phil.
Well, yes, yeah. just in case you didn't know, close your ears. Yeah, they went down. I went for a sit down with, I was saying earlier, with Gilhart and Greenwood yesterday. We just did a sort of quick fire 10-minute Q&A, and Greenwood was joking about the fact that they go into the first team squad and you're trying to stop Leeds going down. You drop down into the 23s and you're trying to stop Leeds going down, and it's almost that thing of, maybe it's us, you know. Maybe it's us. And Gilhart said, you know, it was doing my head in that I go into the 23s and they were struggling as well, and the first team looking like they were in trouble, because I don't think he felt as if either squad should have been. You know, he said he kind of watched what we were doing every day and felt as if this shouldn't really be happening. But the bottom line with the 23s as they were last season was that a huge number of those players were being co-opted for the first team squad because the first team squad was so thin. And actually, as you watch the documentary, and we won't talk too much about what's in it because it'll spoil it for people, but they start the season fairly well, and there's nothing in that at all to suggest that there's trouble coming. And that does, I think, make you realise the kind of the gradual creep towards the point where the 23s were no longer the 23s. And while Bielsa was having to pack his squad with your players from a lower level, so were they.
It's a little bit like the first team, isn't it? You can see the echo, maybe it affected the whole club. It's almost like, I don't know, a car with its handbrake off at the top of a hill. It just starts very, very slowly rolling away from you. You think, oh, I'll be able to get in that. And then you realise it's a car plummeting down a hill. And before you know it, it's running away from you.
Yeah, I think so. And that's, I suspect if you'd done a documentary about the first team last season, it would have been slightly different, because they, as Liam Cooper said over the summer, it just never got going last season, did it? At any point, it just never got on a roll. And there was always that air in the background of things being not quite right or not quite heading for a happy conclusion. The thing about these documentaries that has to be said is that they're produced by Radrizzani's broadcasting studio, Neo Studios, his broadcasting company. So it is essentially an in-house documentary, or it's done with the, you know, the club's permission and the club's oversight. And I was making the point after the second Amazon series, Take Us Home, you know, about the first team and about the Bielsa era, that if you watch season two, and okay, accepting that COVID kind of kicked in and all was there, and made, we will have made some of the broadcasting and everything else difficult, there was no mention at all of Augustine, Jean-Kevin Augustine. There was no mention at all of Kike Casilla's racism charge from the FA. You know, it's not warts and all in that sense.
And in season one, there was quite a lot of, he's very tall and handsome about the chairman and owner as well. I noticed that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have to say, if I was funding a documentary, I'd want them to call me tall and handsome. Sadly, which neither would be true. He's short and he hasn't shaved again.
Look at him, look at him light up the room as he walks in.
Yeah, oh, he's shaved.
He's healthy, well, Scottish pallor.
Well done. But I always like the little bits of nuance in these, you know, the teeny tiny bits that you pick out. There's a funny point where Sean McGurk's fighting to work out how to get a bin bag out of the bin. There's a bit where Max Dean has gone on a sunbed for too long, so it's really sunburned.
It's the bits that humanise them, isn't it?
Yeah, so also, and I did know that Leo Helder had been born in Nottingham, but I didn't expect him to have quite such an English accent, but it makes sense because he's been here for ages and he was up at Celtic for a long time. And he just had this kind of northern to Midlands accent, which sort of catches you by surprise. At first, you're wondering who's talking in the background when he's on camera. But other little things as well, they do some stuff with Charlie Creswell, and he speaks about his Premier League debut against West Ham last season. And one of the first things you see in the footage is Antonio turning him. And he says, you know, the first thing Liam Cooper said to me after that was, don't let him do that. You know, just step off him. Let him have the ball. Don't get tight to him because he's really strong. He's really physical. And he'll do that to you all day. And that goes back to what's quite often said about Cooper, which is that he is a really good communicator at the back. And that, I think, is something Leeds miss when he's not in the defence. That's a really, really experienced, wise pro saying to a young kid, this is what you do and this is how you make it happen.
Diego, don't do any of that.
And that's not the reason why Creswell played well. Like, Creswell played well because he played well, but that will have helped. And I love picking those little bits and pieces out of it. Things like Mark Jackson, how annoyed he gets in the dressing room after when they don't play well and they're not performing as they should be performing, kind of reiterates that point that the attitude of it's all about development at academy level, and that is true to a point, but it's not all about development. You know, there comes a stage where you have to play well and you have to win. And
if he says that, he just says that, doesn't he? Like, it's all about winning. It's about winning.
That's Andrew Taylor, actually, at the start, who took over from Jackson last season when Jackson moved up to the first team squad. Taylor, who's the loans manager at Leeds, stepped in. It was very good, actually. I think a lot of people looked at him and thought, you know, he might be a good option for this if he wanted to do it. But in the end, he wanted to go back to his old loans manager job, which actually will give him something to do this season because Leeds have started farming players out on loan again. But yeah, it's that thing as well about academy football being fun in that they are a really good group together. And, you know, Gilhart and Greenwood in particular are very, very close friends. The two donuts, as Creswell called them when I went down to see him last weekend. But lovely guys, and they go back quite a long way. They were friends from the England Youth setup long before they were friends at Leeds. It just so happened that they joined Leeds from Wigan in Gilhart's case and Arsenal in Greenwood's case within about 2 or 3 weeks of each other. You know, it's total coincidence. But they do all get on really well. They do have a really good laugh together, but then click of a fingers and it's all really serious, isn't it? And
I was going to say there are bits of it that remind me, because we went on a school football trip to the Netherlands when we were in sixth form, so it would have been about 17 at the time, going 18.
Was there any football played on that? Because that sounds like sounds like carnage.
I seem to recall one or two of the lads did get in bother, and there was talk of sending people home, but it may have been too much of a mission. But we did play some football. Yeah, we had a really good time, actually. Some bit of scrapping on the pitch, but that's a different story.
Just to jump in there quickly, when I played for Pennycuick Rugby Club when I was about 17, we went down to Bladen for a sevens tournament. We were all school kids. And it became apparent as soon as we arrived that we were playing against full-grown adults who were massive and were going to destroy us. So what we basically did was throw the first two games in about half an hour and then all just went to the pub for the rest of the day. It was brilliant.
The Netherlands school trip, it just reminded me of that, like the camaraderie that's within the within the under-23s, as it was then when the documentary was made. It is just like a big old bunch of mates on a school trip, but then suddenly you realise they're playing against future Premier League footballers and in Premier League stadiums, whereas we went to play in a field, you know, just outside Amsterdam kind of thing.
But even aside from that, and we're not telling anybody anything they don't know here, you know that can slip away from you so quickly. And there is definitely
that is one of the big themes, isn't it, about how easily this can be lost, because only
Vinnie
a fraction
Jones,
make it.
Vinnie Jones says that early on. It's like touching on the elephant in the room straight away. You know, only a tiny fraction of this bunch will actually make it at the level which they think they're going to make it or want to make
it. Vinnie Jones does the voiceover.
He does, yeah. I should say that. Vinnie is the narrator on this. So you have the kind of the fun aspect of them all together in the dressing room. But when it's down to business, it is down to business. And they must... I asked them, Greenwood and Gilhart, this, whether they think much about what Jones said, you know, that a lot of you are not going to get there because that is just the nature of academies and that's the nature of football. As I say, I think a lot of these players will get there in some capacity. I think a lot of these players will have really good careers. But it's not nailed down and it's not guaranteed. And, you know, both Gilhart and Greenwood kind of said, you know, we've worked hard for this, and yes, we've been lucky and this, that and the other, but you need luck and you need hard work. But also, you don't focus too much on those statistics. You just do what you do and you just trust that it's going to be enough. But you see it with academy players all the time. It looks like an amazing lifestyle, but it takes absolutely nothing for it to disappear and to be taken away from you.
Yeah, there's a nice contrast as well with the sort of high level of the Premier League with those real personalised bits. And, you know, you're talking about one of the players who has kind of fallen by the wayside in terms of Leeds, but is still in the game. Noan Kenner, who is now at your favourite club, Hibs,
yes,
I believe, he's gone up there. He features quite heavily in the first episode, just learning about his background, and he goes back to his school, things like that, which is nice just to get a real glimpse of what these kids are like. And you are reminded that they are only kids, they are humans. Joffy going back home, and you see his mum sat there, you know, beaming from ear to ear, really proud of a little boy, and is looking at his old trophies and things like that. There's some really nice moments in there.
Well, Ken is quite a good example of how things work out, because he features in this and you would assume on that basis that he, you know, and given that you documentary crews are going to home in on players who have interesting stories, but probably also have a good chance of making it. You know, by the time this has been released, i.e. now, he's elsewhere. You know, he's playing up in Scotland. I think Leeds were quite keen to keep him, and it may well in the end have been as much his choice to go and play, because he was always going to get regular games up at Hibs. But he's gone, and likewise Calvin Phillips, who features in the documentary, now over at Manchester City. So he, like Milner, is held up as the kind of poster boy of what happens when everything goes right.
If everything goes right, you get to leave here.
Well, if everything goes right, you get to get promoted with your boyhood club. You get to reach the final of the Euros with England. And
stay
you get
forever.
A big funny move. Yeah.
But that was the thing that absolutely killed me. And this is the one little spoiler I will put in there, is when Calvin Phillips does his little talking head bit at the side of the pitch at Thorpe Arch. And he says, yeah, I'll always be here for the under-23s to talk to. I thought you're not.
Not these under-23s.
Yeah.
Some under-23s.
Over in Manchester.
I'm intrigued to see knowing Kenny, because remember years ago when he kind of was first coming through at the academy, we discovered his personal website that he'd obviously written himself, and it had really sweet, and it had nice pictures of his mum and dad on it.
Like his phone number was on there, wasn't it?
Yeah. He just had his mobile phone number on it. Like, if you want anything, give me a ring.
Speaking of phone numbers, I messaged the Football Cliches podcast earlier this week, because I noticed that Blackpool's Twitter account has its landline on there, which I thought was kind of very 1990s and slightly weird.
Have you been to Blackpool?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
It's very much of that era.
Yes.
It's in the landline era.
If you say so. But yeah, no, a couple of the things that made me laugh were the fact that anytime Bielsa was videoed, you had the feeling that the camera crew was about 8 miles away with the longest lens in the world.
Hidden in some bushes, ironically enough.
Yeah. Which, yeah. You know, is not so different to the Amazon documentary, which he just didn't want. That's not a secret. He just did not want to engage in. And they, you know, they did not want to invade his personal space. But there was also, there's this amusing bit where Creswell is talking about being drafted into the first team squad, and he's saying, for training, he's saying, yeah, so you're a bit like a mannequin or a dummy, you know, on the pitch. And Bielsa did use, in some of the training sessions, he did use the younger players as, you know, kind of like human mannequins and so on, which was all part of the training process and all part of the practice that they went through. But Phillips sort of digs him out of trouble by saying, no, it's not like that. That's not how it is. No, you know, absolutely great. But
teacher may watch this.
What I think I felt this about Bielsa's squad in the Championship, and I feel this about the academy squad as well. They're easy to like. Creswell's a smashing kid, and he was really accommodating last weekend. Weirdly enough, I saw him in King's Cross as I was going home. He had to deal with the delayed trains as well. He was going home for a family do back up north. And bless him, he'd got the tube over from Millwall, the same as me, you know. And I was thinking, if you go on to big things, there ain't going to be many years when you're going to be able to do that. I was saying to him, you need a private helicopter. And he was like, well, you know, maybe if I win the World Cup one day, that'll be happening.
But how old is he now? Is he 19?
But for now, it's oyster cards. He's 20.
20.
He's
20. So imagine that, being 20 years old, you're in an apartment, what's when a Canary Wharf or whatever, versus being at home with your parents. So you're away from home for the first time. You'd be having the time of your life.
Amazing. Yeah. Also, you know, it turns out that he's a right-handed cricket player and right-footed, but plays golf left-handed. He's probably one of those sickening kids at school who was just good at every single sport.
Although my son is right-handed, but brushes his teeth with his left hand. Don't get that either.
That's weird.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm sure Creswell has been a lot more professional than you two would have been. Had you been sent down to London with a load of money and an apartment in Canary Wharf.
Absolutely. Be a good teammate. That's one of the big things that runs through it. Yeah, so they are trying to create good humans as well as good footballers, aren't they?
Yeah, I often wonder how ruthless you have to be in an academy. One of the things with Gilhart and Greenwood was that they're not an identical player, clearly. They kind of play in slightly different positions, although part of me feels that if you boil it down, they're probably best as kind of secondary forward, which is where Gilhart tends to play more often than not. But both Bielsa and Marsh saw Greenwood as a potential midfielder, which is where he's been used a few times. But when they were with England, they were both strikers, you know, so it was direct competition for two players who were sharing a room and were really good mates and very close and in touch outside of England camps as well. And they said, you know, there was never any jealousy with that. They were both happy for each other when it was going well. But there must be, and I don't mean in Leeds Academy specifically, but there must be within academy squads and academy groups that kind of Needle and, you know, jostling for possession, where at the end of the day, if the chance is there for you, you have to take it at somebody else's expense. And you tend to find, and I've always found this at Leeds, that academy players are usually extremely happy for other players who break through. And there don't tend to be many exceptions to that. But there has to be. It's only human nature, isn't it? That thing of if somebody else is getting a run and you're not, that feeling of, I want that.
Yeah. If young Pat Bamford has been drafted in for the game.
You can read that, the Q&A, quickfire Q&A with Joe Gellhart and Sam Greenwood on The Athletic now. Phil's done that. That's live on Friday morning. It's a good read as well. Nice little taster of what is in the documentary that is also streaming from today, 23rd of September. Well, that wraps up the show for today. We'll be skipping Monday, but we'll be back next week previewing Villa. Back to the football.
Yes, just one last thing. If you fancy a night out next week and you're in the vicinity of Leeds, Wednesday night, I'll be doing a Q&A with James Brown, formerly editor of Loaded and Leeds magazine, who has released a book called Animal House, which is about his career and various scrapes during it and life beyond his working life.
It's good. I'm halfway through it. Very good. Yes, you've listened to it all, haven't you, Michael?
I listened to the audiobook whilst reconstructing this very studio we're in. So, no, it's very entertaining. So, I'm sure there'll be some good stories.
Well, true to form with James, the book landed last night and I've got about 3 days to read 400 pages. And if it wasn't for the fact that it's him, I would say that 99% of this book is made up. But given that it is him, I know that 100% of it is true. So this is at the Outlaws Yacht Club in Leeds on Wednesday, September 28th. It's 7 p.m. If you want to come along, I believe it's free to get in. So do.
Yeah, just 5 minutes from the station, that, isn't it? And if you want to read the Q&A with Gellhart and Greenwood, theathletic.com/LeedsPod to sign up for The Athletic. We'll speak to you next week.
The Phil Hay Show.